My name's Ryan Muir. I teach ancient and medieval history at New Covenant Upper School, 7th and 8th grades. David is away this weekend. He's at a wedding in New York, so he asked me to fill in for him. He gave me the subject and some ideas, and I filled in the rest, mostly from my course. I usually teach Rome in 6 weeks in 7th grade, but this will be a quick study of the history of Rome from its founding to the reign of Caesar Augustus. So I'll go over that. David tends to be more on the theological side of things. I'm going to tend to be more on the historical side of things. So this is more or less what you would get if you were in my class at New Covenant. So, yeah. This is the title of our talk today, Rise of Rome, God's Hand at Work to Prepare the World for the Arrival of the Gospel. There are three things that we need to remember when we're looking for God's hand in human history. When we look at a period of time, we should ask ourselves, what is God doing in this period of history? But there are three limitations to our interpretation. One is the fallen condition of man, our own sinfulness, which may cause us to misinterpret what God is doing in history. Our lack of knowledge. Perhaps we just don't know enough about the time that we're interpreting to properly understand it. And three, the ignorance of God's will. Sometimes God's hand is at work, and when we look at history, we just don't quite understand yet what he was doing. With those three caveats in mind, I'm going to endeavor to look at God's hand in human history in the Roman world. There are some things that I want to keep in mind. This is the theme of my talk today. It's what God was doing in preparing the world for the arrival of the gospel. Now, the first main point is God provided peace to build a solid enough culture and society so that the gospel could spread. And we see this build up over the 500 years or so leading up to the birth of Christ, a society in which the rule of law rather than the rule of men is upheld. In most cases, towards the end of the empire, things start to fall apart, where God allowed Rome to expand, to conquer the entire known world. They built a very extensive road system so that it was easy to travel from one part to another. They ended piracy, or at least suppressed it in the Mediterranean, so that Paul could do his three missionary journeys. God raised up men to build and reform his kingdom. We'll see as we go through the history. Certain men, not all of them, some of them, were quite sinful, but at various times in Roman history, we see one person, two people, who come out of the woodwork to ensure that Rome continues. There are numerous pivotal points in Roman history. The Punic Wars is one of them. Is Rome going to expand, or is it going to recede? Who's going to be the main superpower in the Mediterranean? Is it going to be Rome? Is it going to be Carthage? In the east, is it going to be the Seleucid Empire, or is it going to be Rome? And we see at those pivotal points that Rome is continuously lifted up and other kingdoms pass away. God saw the church through centuries of abuse of that kingdom by tyrants. Nero comes to mind, Caligula. But at the same time, he was using the structure of Roman society to build on, and the church will build on that structure for the next 1,000 years until it starts to come into the medieval time period. That's the theme of today's talk, and now we can get into the details. The beginnings of Rome. Two stories about the founding of Rome are well recorded. Both of them are probably mythological. The first one is Romulus and Remus. The second one was the Aeneid, which is passed on to us by Virgil. The story of Romulus and Remus is probably the older one. Romulus and Remus are abandoned and raised by a she-wolf. You remember the famous picture David had it in his slideshow last week of the two Romulus and Remus suckling on the she-wolf. You've probably seen that picture. Romulus kills Remus in a quarrel about where they want to found Rome, and Rome is supposedly founded by Romulus, hence the name Rome. This is a picture of Virgil, who records for us the story of the Aeneid. The story of the Aeneid, Aeneas, who is the sole survivor of Troy, the sacking of Troy, recorded in Homer's The Iliad, escapes. He escapes Troy and goes on an Odyssey-like voyage around the Mediterranean, wanders through the Mediterranean, until he finally comes to Italy, where he marries one of the princesses of the Latin tribe. Rome was founded by the Latin tribe, hence the Latin language that Roman Empire used. We have these two stories. They get blended together later on, where Romulus and Remus and the Aeneid, or Romulus and Remus become descendants of Aeneid, and so those two stories are sort of put together in Roman history to form one story. Whatever the mythological origins of Rome, we do know some archaeological information about Rome. The site of Rome was probably occupied before 1500 BC. It sits on a major trade route, north-south trade route, between the Etruscans in the north and the Sabians in the south. It has a sort of an east-west trade route along the Tiber River. The Seven Hills of Rome, which sit there at the bend of the ford of the Tiber River, makes it a very defensible position. Those small villages that grew up in that area, there were probably trading outposts between the Etruscans and the Sabians, eventually grew together until they probably became one city around 750 BC. I said before, the site of Rome was advantageous. It was a ford of the Tiber River. It was north-south trade route. The Seven Hills of Rome were defensible position. And the east-west, the Tiber River sort of flows northwest-southeast direction. So that also provides a good trade route. Okay. Beginnings of the Roman Republic. We know that Rome was ruled by a king until 509. Between 750 and 509, Rome was ruled by a line of kings. The line of kings ended in 509 BC when King Tarquin the Proud was overthrown by a revolt led by Junius Brutus. Anyone guess Brutus? Yes. The Brutus family, Brutus is their surname, the Brutus family has a long history of hatred of tyrants, and they eventually show up with the death of Julius Caesar in 44 BC. Marcus Brutus, the famous quote from Shakespeare, et tu, Brute? This is the beginning of the long history of the Brutus's family's hatred of tyranny here with the king, Tarquin the Proud. C.S. Lewis, by the way, makes Tarquins in his Narnia books. His Narnia series. The Tarquins are the really bad kings that rule to the south. So he's drawing a little bit here from Roman history. The Republic is established shortly after the overthrow of King Tarquin the Proud. It has an upper house, which is the Senate. It's ruled by 136 families. They are landed families. These are members of the aristocracy. At first, the aristocracy doesn't want to have the plebeians or the poor people have a voice in government. It takes them probably 50 years before the House of Plebes is established. Probably not until the end of the Punic War does the House of Plebes really get more power. They're given the right to elect a tribune. The tribune can stand in the door of the Senate. He's not allowed to come into the Senate. He can just stand in the doorway. If the Senate passes a bill that the tribune doesn't agree with, he can shout, veto, or I forbid, and that is supposed to kill the bill. It doesn't necessarily always happen that way, but that was the idea, House of Plebes. This also introduces the period of the rule of law called Lex Rex, the rule of law. Where the 12 tablets of the law, Rome inscribed on stone tablets, 12 stone tablets, the basic laws of Rome. And these are put down in very plain language so that everybody, even farmers, can understand them. That is the beginning of the rule of law. Rather than having a king or a dictator or an emperor, say, my word is law, whatever I say goes, we now have established laws that everybody is supposed to abide by, and they're written down on stone so that everybody can read them. And they're not to be interpreted by a special class of lawyers who know the correct interpretation of the law. They're written in very plain language. That's important for the development of Rome because in a society in which everybody knows the rules, it's not dependent upon the king or the emperor who can change his mind anytime. That provides a degree of stability. Okay. The expansion of the Roman Empire. Shortly after Rome becomes a republic, it starts to expand. It fights a series of wars against its neighbors on the Italian peninsula. The Samnites, the Etruscans, there are Greek colonies there. So slowly over the next 200 years or so, they begin to expand. The Second Samnite War in 290 to 289 BC is the final victory of Rome and the control over Italy. This is, they have, in the last couple hundred years, slowly expanded their rule until finally it covers all of Italy. You can see there's a key up in the upper right-hand corner. You can see on the key various periods in which Rome slowly expands its power. The green area is what we're going to talk about next. That is the area that is won during the Punic Wars. There are three Punic Wars between Rome and the Phoenician city-state of Carthage. Carthage, it would be located relatively near the modern city of Tripoli in the country of Libya. It is a Phoenician city-state. The Phoenicians, you see them come up in the Bible a couple of times. They originated in Lebanon. They were great sea traders. They eventually get pushed out of Lebanon and move over to Libya. They found the city-state of Carthage. Carthage begins to grow and to develop trade routes all over the Mediterranean Sea. In fact, we'll move back here just a little bit. They have, if you can see down here, this Sicily, and down here would be Libya. This is the top corner of Libya. They have expanded all over Sicily, Sardinia, Corsica, Spain. They are a slowly growing empire as well, just as Italy, or just as Rome is, and they're about to collide, and they do collide during the First Punic War. First Punic War was over trade with Sicily. Italy, Rome is wanting to have trade with Sicily. Phoenicia says, before you can trade with Sicily, you have to pay us tribute. Rome says, we're not going to pay you tribute. We're our own empire. We're not part of your client states. We're going to go to war so we can trade with Italy or Sicily freely. There's only one problem here. This is largely a naval battle. It's a war over trade, naval or sea trade in the Mediterranean. And Rome doesn't have any navy. Carthage has a huge navy, which they've used for hundreds of years to control trade in the Mediterranean. So Rome is at a serious disadvantage. In fact, they don't even know how to build a warship. They eventually find a Carthaginian ship that has been abandoned at sea and run aground in Italy. They set to copying it. They make 140 copies of the same ship. At the same time, they've got Romans practicing rowing on the beach. They set up benches on the beach with oars to practice rowing together. And they go into their first battle, and they try to outmaneuver the Carthaginians. The Carthaginians, or the style of naval warfare at this time, is you try to get to the side of your enemy and slam into them with your ship. The ships have a ram on the front of them, and when you slam into them, their ship breaks in half and sinks. That's the style of naval warfare at this time. Well, it takes a good deal of maneuverability because your opponent is trying to do the same thing to you. That relies greatly upon the skill of the naval captains. Well, Carthage has the skill, and the first battle doesn't go well for Rome. They lose miserably in their first battle. So Rome says, well, enough of this. We're not going to play the Carthaginian game. We're going to play our game. Our game is land warfare. We are the best at land warfare, so let's just make the naval battle a land battle. So what they do is they put a ramp on the front of their ship. And on the front of the ramp are some large spikes. They just run up to the Carthaginian ships, drop the ramp called a corvus, which means raven in Latin, sinks into the Carthaginian ship, providing a stable platform for the Roman legions just to march across and kill everybody on the Carthaginian ship. Not only do they prevail in land war, which is essentially now a land combat, naval marines against each other, but they've now captured the Carthaginian ship. And that goes very well for them. They have a stunning come-from-behind victory from having no navy to defeating the most powerful navy in the world and win the First Punic War, allowing them to trade with Corsica and Sardinia, or in Sicily. Yeah. This is the Second Punic War. The Carthaginians didn't take well to being defeated in the First Punic War. They stage a preemptive attack. Hannibal, he's the general on the top there. Hannibal marches out of Spain with his army. He's got, I think, 37 elephants with him. And he marches his army over the Alps and into northern Italy. He wins three very stunning victories against the Romans, in which three legions are annihilated. More than 150,000 Roman soldiers die in these three major victories, the last one being Cannae. Rome is devastated. They've lost their pride of their military force. But they keep coming. Young boys, old men, volunteer for the military. And one legion after another is wiped out, but Rome is able to raise more legions. They even eventually resort to raising a legion of slaves, freed slaves, to defend Rome. Hannibal marches all over Italy. Rome is unable to raise an army to defeat him. Hannibal marches all over Italy for 15 years, but there are one thing that he cannot do. He cannot penetrate the fortified cities of the Romans. So he's reduced to marching around Italy, burning up the Italian crops, hoping to starve them out. The Romans are doing the same thing to him. They have a scorched earth policy where they're trying to deny food and provisions to Hannibal's army. So this becomes a very long and protracted war in Italy. Eventually, a Roman general named P. Scipio, that's him on the bottom, sort of mean-looking fellow, he leads an army out of Italy and into Spain, which is Hannibal's home territory. He's able to conquer Spain. And from Spain, he launches an attack on the city of Carthage. Hannibal was forced to leave Italy and go back to Carthage to defend it from Scipio's army. And he loses the Battle of Zama, ending the Second Punic War. Third Punic War. The Third Punic War was probably unnecessary. This is Rome's revenge. Excuse me. Rome's revenge for Hannibal torching their country for 15 years. They launched a Third Punic War. They easily defeat Carthage in just 3 years. They completely destroy Carthage at this time. They tear down the buildings. They burn the buildings, tear down the walls. They plow under the olive orchards and the vineyards. And they even sow the vineyards with salt so that nothing will grow there. So it's another 100, 150 years before the site of Carthage is occupied again. Rome can be a very, for lack of a better word, mean to anybody who stands in her way. 190 BC, Greece is conquered after unwisely siding with Hannibal in the Second Punic War. Hannibal flees after the Second Punic War, seeks refuge in Greece. Greece says, okay, the Romans used that as a pretense for conquering Greece. So now you can see, Greece is formally annexed in 133 AD. Now you can see that the Roman Empire is slowly expanding. Started with Rome, then they fought the Sabians and the Etruscans and the Greek colonies. That expanded their influence over all of Italy. They only 20 years after they consolidated their power in Italy, they had a war with Carthage over trade with Sicily, Sardinia, and Corsica. They won that war in an amazing come from behind victory. They endured a very long and costly Second Punic War, which the victory there gave them control of Spain. After the Third Punic War, they controlled what's North Africa, Libya, Morocco, Algeria. So things are expanding. They also conquered Greece. So now they have basically everything from Greece over to Spain, going north up to the Alps, and on the south from Morocco over to Libya. This is putting some strain. This is putting some strain on their empire. First, there's a growing middle class. Trade with all these outlying areas, trade with Spain, trade with North Africa, with Greece, the Balkans, Sicily, Corsica, Sardinia, is developing a middle class of merchants. And those merchants are wanting more political power. They're beginning to challenge the old landed families of Rome for political power. At the same time, slaves that are brought in from all these conquered people are displacing the working class. It's much easier to have a slave do your work for you than to pay somebody to do it. So two major important things. One, a rising middle class, and two, vast unemployment in the underclass. The new slaves equal high unemployment for the poor. This sets the stage for serious political problems in Rome, out of which the Roman Empire switched from a republic to an empire gradually over the next 150 years. Yeah, pretty cool. Around 140 BC, there are two brothers, Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus. Tiberius is on the left. They propose reforms. They're in the House of Plebes. They propose some reforms. We want to take land away from the ruling class, the ruling landed class, that would be the senators. Remember the 136 aristocratic families, land-owning families that made up the Senate. And we want to give it to the poor, those unemployed people who were put out of work because of the import of slavery. And that way we'll redistribute the wealth and allow those poor people to sort of work their way up out of poverty through the use of land. You can imagine that was very unpopular with the Senate, the landholding people, but it was very popular among the poor. Much like Adolf Hitler did in the early period of World War II, or prior to World War II, the Gaius brothers had mobs of people that, as their followers, and they sort of lead their mobs into the street to force the Senate to comply with their demands. The Senate responds with the army. First, Tiberius is killed with 300 of his followers in a street battle. The masses elect Tiberius's brother, Gaius, to replace him as tribune. Gaius forces through some of these reforms, but the Senate is not willing to fund it. This is sort of an unfunded mandate. So you have to get this land back, and you have to pay people for it, but the Senate is not willing to make available the funds to pay people for their land. Gaius passes reforms, but the Senate won't enforce them. Gaius is killed in a street battle. Once again, he leads his followers, the poor, landless people, into the streets in an attempt to force the Senate to pay for his reforms. And he and 3,000 of his followers are killed in a street battle. Shortly thereafter, there's still a problem with unemployment, disaffected masses of people in Rome. So this man, who's a general, Marcius comes up with an idea. We'll take all of the unemployed people and we'll put them into the army. That way they'll have a job, they'll be in the army, and we can pay them if we go out and conquer new people. We go out and conquer new people, and those conquests will pay for the army, and that will solve the problem of unemployment. He proposes a professional military. I should say a little bit about the history of the Roman military. It started out before the Punic War as an all-volunteer, unpaid military. You were expected to leave your family. These are sort of the Minutemen. Leave your family. Join the army, go out to fight without being paid for Rome. During the Punic period, the wars are longer. The Second Punic War lasts more than 15 years. So they start paying the soldiers for their service. They still volunteer. Once the war is over, they're sent back to their land or their jobs. What Marcius is proposing here is a permanent, full-time, paid professional army. He does it in hopes of relieving unemployment. The payment is supposed to be through the conquests of new lands. It has one major unexpected or perhaps expected side effect. The loyalty shifts from the country to the general. It's the general who's responsible for paying the army. He promises them, usually, after you serve with me 20 or 30 years, I'll give you a plot of land and whatever spoils that you have earned from your conquest. That is a big shift away from the system of the Republic, because now the masses are loyal to the generals rather than the politicians or the city. And we'll see from now on until the birth of Christ, general after general after general after general rises to power using the army. The first one is the dictator Sulla. Marcius is making reforms. He's on what's called the populi, the popular side of government. He's representing the poor, trying to make reforms to alleviate the poverty and unemployment. Senate is still weary of Marcius, even though he's a general. They are concerned about his motivations. Marcius, although he wins numerous victories in Spain and in Carthage or in North Africa, he is passed over for command of the Eastern Army. The Eastern Empire is Greece and so on. It was its most wealthiest part of the empire. He's passed over for command of the Eastern Empire. Instead, Sulla, who is loyal to the Senate, is appointed command of the Eastern Empire. Marcius responds by going to the House of Plebes and saying, this is a travesty. This is a play for power by the Senate. They've appointed one of their own to have command of the Eastern armies, 8 legions. You must elect me commander of the Eastern legions so that we can preserve the newfound freedom and power of the populace. They do, setting the stage for a war. Sulla brings his 8 legions from the east back to Rome to fight Marcius and his legions that he's brought from the west, and they fight a bitter civil war for 5 years before Sulla wins, and he's declared dictator of Rome. He's declared dictator for 3 years just to get things back to normal after this first civil war. He rules the dictator for 3 years. He undoes all the reforms of the Gracchi and Marcius before stepping down in 79 BC. This leads us to a period of expansion. There are 3 people that are important in this period. Pompey, who is a general, or actually all these famous people are important people, are generals. Pompey, Crassus, who is the wealthiest man in Rome, and Julius Caesar. Pompey is famous, he wins his fame by going into the east and conquering the kingdom of Palmyra, which is in present-day Turkey. While he's there, he takes a detour a little bit further south and conquers Israel. While he's conquering Jerusalem, he enters the temple in that famous scene where he goes and tears down the curtain that separates the holies of holies and enters and finds that there's nothing there. He becomes very famous for that conquest, brings a great deal of wealth as well as new land into the Roman Empire. In doing so, gains a great deal of political wealth, political popularity. He is elected consul, one of the 2 leaders of the Senate. He's also sent with an army. There's a rash of piracy around Crete. He's sent with an army to destroy the pirates. He becomes extremely popular and wealthy. Crassus also has an army. He does similar things. He conquers some land and generates a vast amount of wealth. There's a law. You can only be consul 1 year, that is the 2 leaders of the Senate. You can only be consul 1 year, and then you have to wait 10 years before you can be consul again. So in their stead, they pick an ambitious young nobleman, Julius Caesar, to be their voice in the council. Julius Caesar becomes a consul in 59 BC through the support of Pompey and Crassus. After his 1 year term as consul, he's promoted to the governor of Transalpine Gaul, which is the region of, well, yes. Transalpine Gaul, though, is actually what would today be Switzerland. He leads the army out of Transalpine Gaul to Gaul, which is the present-day France. He leads his army on a 10-year journey to conquer France. He gains a great deal of wealth and political influence. He's a master of the press, continually sends back glowing reports of his victories against the Gauls and how much wealth he's bringing into Rome. So he becomes extremely popular in Rome. He comes back, this popularity threatens Pompey. Pompey becomes, his 10 years is over, he becomes consul again. He recalls Caesar from Gaul. Come back, Caesar. Come back to the city. And by the way, leave your army there in France. Caesar sees through this. He knows that if he goes back to Rome without his army, he's never coming out. He's a threat to Pompey's power. So instead, he brings his army. The northern border of Italy at this point, the point where outside rulers were not supposed to bring their armies in. Did anyone guess? The Rubicon River. The Rubicon River is the point where you're not supposed to bring your armies past. He crosses the Rubicon. That's where that saying comes from. He makes the famous saying, "The die is cast." It has a double meaning. In other words, I'm set in this. Whoops. That's interesting. Okay. I'm set in this course of action, but it also has the double meaning of like a set of die that has been cast, and you don't know what the outcome is going to be. So he brings his army into Rome. Pompey flees to Greece. Caesar follows him with his army to Greece, defeats them in a battle in Greece. Defeats his army at Pharsalus in 48 BC. Pompey leaves Egypt, or leaves Greece, flees across the Mediterranean to Egypt. Egypt is in the middle of a little bit of a civil war here. There's a little bit of conflict going on between Cleopatra and her brother. His name's Ptolemy, I think his name is. He's Ptolemy the 7th or something. Caesar shows up with his army chasing Pompey. The young pharaoh, Cleopatra's brother, kills Pompey and sends his head to Caesar, saying, "Here is your enemy. Egypt is not gonna contest with Rome. There's your enemy." However, Cleopatra goes to meet Caesar and convinces him that if he will put her on the throne, then Egypt will truly, Egypt and Rome will be truly united. And that's what he does. He knocks off Cleopatra's brother, puts Cleopatra on the throne, and annexes Egypt. Okay. He stays there for a little while, subduing Egypt and North Africa. He has a child with Cleopatra. And then he returns to Rome. He returns to Rome in 46 BC, where he's declared dictator for life. The role of dictator is an emergency role. This is like martial law. In Rome, you're only supposed to be dictator for 1 year. Caesar is declared dictator for life. You can see many Latin American dictators have the same thing done for them. Dictator for life. This doesn't sit well with the Senate, who is now basically out of power because Caesar has basically taken over power. And he's assassinated. He's assassinated by a group of conspirators led by Marcus Brutus, the descendant of Junius Brutus, who was the first. There's a lot of symbolic power here. Descendant of Junius Brutus, the person who overthrew the King Tarquin the Proud. Marcus Brutus. We did that good. You can see here. This is sort of an ironic thing. This is supposed to be Brutus here. He's covering his face so that Caesar doesn't know that it's him. But this is an artist's rendition. The famous quote. Et tu, Brute? What is really ironic is that Caesar is killed at the feet of the statue of Pompey. This is the statue of Pompey. The historians tell us that he was killed at the feet of the statue of Pompey, whom Caesar killed in order to gain power. So it's sort of a ironic twist there. he's killed at the feet of Pompey, who he killed to gain power. Yeah. There is another war. Caesar's right-hand man, his what is called master of horses, is Mark Antony. Mark Antony teams with Octavian, who is has been adopted. I think it's his nephew. Yes, his nephew of Caesar, and who's been appointed to be his successor. They lead an army to kill Brutus. The army defeats Brutus near Philippi in Greece, leading to the second triumvirate, second rule by three people. In this case, it's Antony, Octavian, and Lepidus. Lepidus is a general who has control of the Spanish legions. Antony was Caesar's master of horses, and Octavian was his appointed successor. So they carve up the empire. Antony's the West, and Lepidus gets stuck with North Africa, which is not all that profitable. Mark Antony becomes involved with Cleopatra. He proclaims Julius Caesar's son with Cleopatra, the king of kings, and doles out part of the empire to her various children, saying, when I die, you'll get Turkey, and you'll get Israel, and you'll get Greece, and so on. Octavius cannot let this is a direct challenge to Octavian's power. That's Octavian. By 32 BC, there can be no more pretense of cooperation between Octavian and Mark Antony. Lepidus has been sort of squirreled away in North Africa, so he is not there. Octavian settles the matter in the Battle of Actium, after which Cleopatra and Mark Antony famously commit suicide. Cleopatra by holding an asp and being bitten by an asp. Octavian becomes the sole emperor of Rome. Octavian is the ruler at the birth of Christ. The skull in our timeline uses 3 BC as the birth of Christ. I know there's a little bit of debate about that. I think that's probably the best year. It's the year the school uses. Octavian in 31 BC becomes emperor. His reign lasts until 14 BC. He's a very long ruled emperor. He does a lot of good things for Rome. He launches on a building campaign that the famous saying is, Octavian finds Rome made out of clay and he leaves it made out of marble. He's renamed the Emperor Caesar Augustus. So you can hear either Octavian or Caesar Augustus. It's the same person. His rule rushes in a period of peace called the Pax Romana, which lasted approximately 200 years. This is the time in which the church grows from approximately 30 AD until, it continues to grow. Constantine eventually makes Christianity legal in 332 AD. Octavian rules until 14 AD. Tiberius, Octavius's stepson, rules from 14 AD to 37 AD, and Christ is crucified in 30 AD. So we can see the history. Certain periods of time when Rome is on the brink of either collapse or being defeated. We can see at periods of time, Rome comes through just astonishing odds to spread and to conquer the entire known world at this time. This enables the spread of the gospel by introducing safe road and sea lanes, a common language, the rule of law. We see Paul appeal to the rule of law a couple of times in the epistles, where he says, "Is it lawful for you to beat a man who's a Roman citizen?" And another time when he is before Felix, and he appeals to have a trial before Caesar. We see a common language that people can speak spread the gospel. Okay. We also don't underestimate the importance of the institution, the Roman institution, in the church later on, especially under Constantine, where the church and the state start to become synonymous. Yeah. Questions? No questions?
It's an interesting tidbit.
Sure.
About Octavian and Tiberius. You know, Octavian was married to Livia.
Yes.
Not Livia, Livia.
Yes.
She and Tiberius was her son. And she wanted to have her son succeed Octavian.
Yes.
Even though he was not of the blood, of his line. So she managed to eliminate everybody.
Well, we find that many times.
And the possibility that she poisoned her husband toward the end with poisoned fig leaves. She put poison, not in fig leaves, in figs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we find that again in Tiberius and Nero. Tiberius's wife probably does him in so that her son Nero can get on the throne. Questions? Okay. Good. Well, I guess you're dismissed.